new moral politics that transcends the old categories of both the secular left and the religious right, I believe it is time to assert this clear fourth political option. What we need is nothing less than prophetic politics. We must find a new moral and political language that transcends old divisions and seeks the common good. Prophetic politics finds its center in fundamental moral issues like children, diversity, family, community, citizenship, and ethics. Others could be added, like nonviolence, tolerance, and fairness, and tries to construct national directions that many people across the political spectrum could agree to. It would speak directly to the proverb quoted earlier, "Without a vision, the people perish," and would offer genuine political vision that arises out of biblical passages from prophetic texts. Our own ancient prophetic religious traditions could offer a way forward beyond our polarized and paralyzed national politics, and could be the foundation for a fourth political option to provide the new ideas politics always needs. The two major traditional options in America, Democrat, liberal, and Republican, conservative, have failed to capture the imagination, commitment, and trust of a clear majority of people in this country. Neither has found ways to solve our deepest and most entrenched social problems. Record prosperity hasn't cured child poverty. Family breakdown is occurring across all class and racial lines. Public education remains a disaster for millions of families. Millions more still don't have health insurance or can't find affordable housing. The environment suffers from unresolved debates, while our popular culture becomes more and more polluted by violent and sex-saturated entertainment. In local communities, people are more and more isolated, busy, and disconnected. Our foreign policy has become an aggressive assertion of military superiority in a defensive and reactive mode, seeking to protect us against growing and invisible threats instead of addressing the root causes of those threats. The political right and left continue at war with each other, but the truth is that these false ideological choices themselves have run their course and become dysfunctional. Prophetic politics would not be an endless argument between personal and social responsibility, but a weaving of the two together in search of the common good. The current options are deadlocked. Prophetic politics wouldn't assign all the answers to the government, the market, or the churches and charities, but rather would patiently and creatively forge new civic partnerships in which everyone does their share and everybody does what they do best. Prophetic politics wouldn't debate whether our strategy should be cultural, political, or economic, but would show how they must be all three, led by a moral compass. Perhaps most importantly, prophetic politics won't be led just by elected officials, lawyers, and their financial backers. Look for community organizers, social entrepreneurs, nonprofit organizations, faith-based communities, and parents to help show the way forward now. Pay particular attention to a whole generation of young people forged in community service. They may be cynical about politics, but they are vitally concerned with public life. The politics we need now will arise more from building social and spiritual movements than from merely lobbying at party conventions. And ultimately, it will influence the party conventions, as successful movements always do. The prophetic role churches are now undertaking is illustrative of the larger public vocation that may now be required. That role has become more clear in the wake of the election. Without a clear and compelling vision, Democrats had nothing to offer the American people as an alternative to the Bush administration. With the Republicans offering war overseas and corporate dominance at home, and the Democrats failing to offer any real alternatives, who will raise a prophetic voice for social and economic justice and for peace? Never has there been a clearer role for the churches and religious community. We can push both parties toward moral consistency and their best stated values and away from the unprincipled pragmatism and negative campaigning that both sides too often engaged in during the recent election. The courage many church leaders showed in opposing the war with Iraq is an early sign of that prophetic role. so is the growing unity across the spectrum of the churches on the issue of poverty. The truth is that there are more churches committed to justice and peace than belong to the religious right. It's time the voice of those congregations be heard, and their activism be mobilized to become the conscience of American politics in a time of crisis. We have seen many moments in recent history when the churches emerged as the leading voice of political conscience. Certainly, there were key times in the South African struggle against apartheid when the churches there became the critical public voice, both for political challenge and for change. Leaders such as Desmond Tutu, Alan Bosack, and Frank Chikane served as both church and public figures at the same time. Who can forget the role of Archbishop Oscar Romero in El Salvador during the 1980s? Church leaders in the Philippines during the revolution that ousted dictator Ferdinand Marcos, or the critical opposition to communist rule in Poland. In many other oppressive circumstances, churches and church leaders have risen to the call to prophetic public leadership. With religious fundamentalists on one side and secular fundamentalists on the other, how should religious people express their vision of faith and politics? How do we do more than conform to existing options and instead help create better alternatives for solving the pressing problems of our society? And most particularly, how are we to vote? First, we should ask what the religious profession of candidates actually means for their policymaking. If religious affirmation is not tied to real political values and directions, what good is the expression of such public piety? And how could genuine discussion of moral, spiritual, or religious values in public life contribute to the formation of needed new political options? When George Bush said in the 2000 presidential campaign that Jesus was his favorite philosopher, it was fair to ask what that meant for his political philosophy. Would the poor get prioritized on his policy agenda as they did with Jesus? And the same with Al Gore's claim that he often asked himself, "What would Jesus do?" Which candidates' political commitments were more likely to focus on the bottom 20% of American families, including 13 million children who are living in poverty and shut out of our national well-being? Bush should have been asked if child poverty would get more attention in his administration than oil and gas interests. Gore should have been asked how he would implement his new populist rhetoric when it inevitably collided with the interest of the corporations that now finance both political parties. How does the religious principle of the sacredness of human life challenge all the candidates, for example, on abortion, capital punishment, military spending, missile defense, or gun control? Religious people may disagree on the answers to those questions. For example, Joe Lieberman supports both capital punishment and legal abortion, while the Catholic bishops do not. But shouldn't the highest rates of both abortion and death row executions in the Western world be a concern to all those who profess moral values? Couldn't both pro-life and pro-choice political leaders agree to common ground actions that would actually reduce the abortion rate, rather than continue to use abortion mostly as a political symbol? Instead of imposing rigid pro-choice and pro-life political litmus tests, why not work together on teen pregnancy, adoption reform, and real alternatives for women backed into dangerous and lonely corners? Do we really want to dramatically reduce abortion and make it rare, as Bill Clinton once suggested? Or have both sides just continued to treat this deeply important issue as a political football? It's an appropriate moral concern to ask candidates about their plans to extend health care and education to those without them. And protecting the environment is as much a religious issue as caring for the poor. What if religious voters ask which candidates see human rights and workers' protections to be as important as global trade? And here is another tough values question for both parties. How does allegiance to the Christian Prince of Peace, or the God of the Hebrew prophets, square with a national security policy that still relies on threatening the use of nuclear weapons, something all of our religious traditions abhor? What does the same sacredness of human life principle mean for foreign and military policy? Chicago's late Catholic cardinal, Joseph Bernardin, often spoke of a seamless garment of life, which applied to any issue where human lives are at stake, from abortion and euthanasia to capital punishment and nuclear weapons to poverty and racism. Applying that consistent life ethic to politics would upset the ideological apple carts of both Republicans and Democrats, which would be a very good role for the religious community. Perhaps the most mistaken media perception of our time is that religious influence in politics only equates to the politics of the religious right. The biggest story that the mainstream media has yet to discover is how much that reality is changing. My prediction is that moderate and progressive religious voices will ultimately shape politics in the coming decades far more significantly than the religious right will. First, it is a mistake to regard all the conservative Christians who are sympathetic to the religious right as people who want to impose their religious values on fellow citizens. To be conservative is not necessarily to be fundamentalist. In my experience, most are motivated more by defensive feelings than offensive intentions. Many people of faith, of all different political stripes, are concerned about the coarsening of American life, the unraveling of traditional values, and threats to religious precepts like the sacredness of human life. What our children are being subjected to on television, in schoolyards, and now over the internet has become a greater motivating force for political involvement than keeping the Ten Commandments in state courthouses or any number of other issues on the agenda of the political right wing. It is true that some of the religious right's leaders are indeed theocrats, those who would impose their versions of morality on the nation if they ever had the chance. As we have discussed, their mistake was the attempt to take political power in and through the Republican Party to impose a moral agenda from the top down. But even more disconcerting has been what is missing from the agenda of the religious right, such as concern for the poor and racial justice, and the appeals of the movement's leaders to affluent self-interest over biblical imperatives. How did tax cuts for the rich become a religious imperative? Those blatant hypocrisies of the religious right are becoming more and more evident, especially to a new generation of evangelical Christians. History does teach us that the most effective social movements are also spiritual ones, which change people's thinking and attitudes by appealing to moral and religious values. Those movements change the cultural and political climate, which then makes policy changes more possible, palatable, and yes, democratic. The best example of doing it right, as we have said, is the American Civil Rights Movement, which was led by ministers who appealed directly to biblical faith. I believe that will be the more likely pattern for future movements that combine faith and politics, replacing the more politically conformist model of the religious right. The U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops has provided real social policy leadership in the last decade and has become a clear alternative to the dominance of groups like the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition. The Catholic bishops are opposed to abortion, but also to capital punishment, increased military spending, and notions of welfare reform that neglect poor working families. Influential organizations like World Vision and World Relief are playing leadership roles in sensitizing and mobilizing evangelicals for disaster relief, comprehensive economic development, and global campaigns to combat HIV/AIDS. New leadership in the mainline Protestant churches also promises greater ecumenical collaboration on social issues with both evangelicals and Catholics. To move away from the bifurcating politics of liberal and conservative, left and right, would be an enormously positive change and would open up a new politics of solutions. Right now, Washington responds to a problem or crisis in two ways. First, politicians try to make us afraid of the problem, and second, they look for somebody to blame for it. Then they watch to see whose political spin succeeded, either in the next poll or the next election. But they seldom get around to actually solving the problem. The media make everything worse by assuming that every political issue has only two sides, instead of multiple angles for viewing and solving the problem. Addicted to conflict as their media methodology, they want always to pitch a fight between polarized views instead of convening a public discussion to find serious answers. The answer is to put values at the center of political discourse and in every public debate, to ask what kind of country and people we really want to be. We would find new agreements across old political boundaries and new common ground among people who agree on values and are ready to challenge the special interests on all sides who are obstructing the solutions most Americans would support. Ideologies have failed us. Values can unite us, especially around our most common democratic visions. My travel and speaking schedule is still pretty busy, but fatherhood has changed all my routines. I try not to be away for more than one or two nights running, even coming home in the middle of the night to be there in the morning when Luke and Jack wake up. Being away from the boys and Joy for longer than a day or two is too much for me. And now that my son Luke is 6 years old, we can have great phone conversations whenever I'm away, often several times a day. When Luke was just 4, I was speaking at a conference in Florida and had already talked with him a couple of times during the day. But when I got back to my hotel room that night, there was a voicemail waiting for me from Luke. After all, several hours had passed since we had spoken, and there were lots of things to tell me about. His little voice always brings a smile to my face, as he enthusiastically gives me a blow-by-blow account of his day's activities. Luke's phone sign-off has become especially wonderful and always warms the hearts of his mom and dad. "Daddy, I love you, I like you, and you're incredible." It's just the kind of unconditional affirmation we all need, but find hard to accept. I suspect it's close to what God wants to tell us sometimes, but it's probably easier to receive it from a child. But then Luke finished with something he had never said before. Completely out of the blue, my 4-year-old son said, "Daddy, don't be afraid." I could hear his mom catch her breath in the background. Where did a little child find those words? They hadn't been talking about anything that could have prompted it. "Be not afraid," were the most frequent words of Jesus to his disciples in the New Testament. He kept repeating the instruction over and over, as if he knew how much his followers needed to hear it. Today in the United States, we have a foreign policy based primarily on fear. We move back and forth between new national color codes, indicating the level of danger from terrorist attack. The Office of Homeland Security regularly moves the nation to Orange Alert, the second highest state of risk for terrorist violence. September 11, 2001 changed our lives, and since then, we have become a nation always living in fear. We were terrified by the murderous attacks on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon, and even after dramatic war victories in Afghanistan and Iraq, America is still afraid. Indeed, the war in Iraq was argued and justified almost entirely on the basis of fear. It was Trappist monk Thomas Merton who said many years ago, "The root of war is fear." There are indeed real dangers prowling about our world. Prudence and strategic action are called for, as is much deeper reflection on the causes of those dangers. But fear can cause us to give up important things, to accept other things that violate our own best values, and even to do terrible things to other people. Fear has led us into a new foreign policy based on preemptive and potentially endless wars, which are not likely to remove our fears and could likely make the dangers we face even worse. September 11th shattered the American sense of invulnerability. But instead of accepting the vulnerability that most of the rest of the world already lives with, and even learning from it, we seem to want something nobody can give us, to erase our vulnerability. We want it to just go away. If the government says more wars can do that, many people will say fine. If they say suspending civil liberties can do that, many will say fine. If they claim spending more and more of our tax dollars on the military and homeland security will do it, at the expense of everything else, many will say fine. But we simply can't erase our vulnerability, not in this world, and not with the human condition being as it is. To be prudent and vigilant in the face of danger is good. But when a government offers to take away our vulnerability, it borders on idolatry. I am convinced that mere political action to counter a foreign policy based primarily on fear will not be enough. We must go deeper, to the roots of the fear. Courage is not the absence of fear, but the resistance to it. For people of faith, it means trusting God in the face of our vulnerabilities. We need nothing less than the healing of the nation, beginning with our own fears. That healing will be essential to make peacemaking possible. Just a few weeks after the attacks, I went to Ground Zero in New York City. Awestruck was the only word that came to mind after seeing the scope of the devastation at what was once the World Trade Center on the Lower West Side of Manhattan. Thanks to the good graces of the local clergy and Red Cross, I was able to get right onto the site. All the pictures I'd seen couldn't fully capture the enormity of the destruction that stood before me. Standing on the pile, I prayed and wondered what might come out of this incredible and atrocious event. I met people doing extraordinary things that day, but I was especially struck with several groups of firefighters from cities around the country and Canada. They had come to attend memorial services and just to be here, as one young fireman told me. After speaking to several of these men and women, I realized what was going on. They were pilgrims visiting a holy site. That's what their faces and voices revealed to me. I've been to other holy sites and seen other pilgrims, and now saw the same things at a place that would forever be remembered. How will the events of September 11th change us, I wondered. Will they change us? I began to believe that September 11th could either become a doorway to transformation or set us back for years. America had been attacked more massively and viciously than at any other time in our history. How would we respond? What were the choices before us? I believe that September 11th was what might be justly called a teachable moment, a time to understand and critically examine ourselves and our relationship to the world. The loss of so many lives, which were sacred, and the heroism of sacrifice offered there made Ground Zero in New York City a sacred place. In a way, we've all become pilgrims now. My hope remains that this pilgrimage could still change us. Something extraordinary had just happened to us as a nation. We experienced both our vulnerability and our unity as never before. Out of horrible death and destruction came powerful acts of compassion, courage, and heroism. Thousands of us were killed, and the whole nation felt deeply connected to the lives lost. Our reaction to these momentous events would truly be a test of our national character, as the religious leader's statement said. Most every American wanted a strong response to the attacks of September 11th, but two paths emerged in reaction to the terror that had been visited upon us. One spoke the language and spirit of justice and invoked the rule of law in promising to bring the perpetrators of terrorist violence to accountability. Those who so violated the standards of civilized life and the human values we hold most dear should never be allowed to escape judgment and punishment, and the danger of even more terror must be urgently prevented. The other path used the language of war and invoked a spirit of retribution and even vengeance, emotions we can all understand. A war on terrorism summons up the strength and resolve to stop these horrific acts and prevent their cancerous spread. But the war language fails to provide moral and practical boundaries for that response. It could lead to indiscriminate retaliation and the collateral damage of even more loss of innocent life. Certainly, the victory of the terrorists must be denied. They and what they represent must be soundly defeated. But the question we faced was how to do that. The religious leaders said, "We can deny them their victory by refusing to submit to a world created in their image. We must not allow this terror to drive us away from being the people God has called us to be." While they demanded that those responsible for these utterly evil acts be found and brought to justice, they insisted that we must not, out of anger and vengeance, indiscriminately retaliate in ways that bring on even more loss of innocent life. Shortly after September 11th, A Gallup poll reported that 73% of the American people believed our response should be targeted only against those responsible for the terrorist attacks on America. I believe such public opinion was motivated not only by moral considerations, but also by pragmatic concerns. Bombing the children of Kabul and Baghdad created utter glee among the Osama bin Ladens of the world, who finally are able to raise the armies of terror they've always dreamed of. It also deprived us of the moral high ground that the United States held in world opinion immediately after September 11th, for the first time in many years. Many of us said a more courageous response would be required. Discipline, patience, and perseverance in vanquishing the networks, assets, and capabilities of violent terrorists was the path most likely to be effective, rather than merely cathartic. An even more courageous national commitment would be to face honestly the grievances and injustices that breed rage and vengeance and are continually exploited by terrorists to recruit the angry and desperate. American religious leaders began to take on the prophetic role of answering why this happened, or, as many have put the question, why are so many people angry at us? The first two tasks, while major undertakings, were easier to define. It was the third challenge that required our best discernment and genuine soul-searching. It is indeed impossible to comprehend adequately the terrorist attacks of September 11th without a deeper understanding of the grievances and injustices felt by millions of people around the world. That is a painful subject that the U.S. government mostly refuses to engage, the mainstream media avoid, and many Americans are unable to hear when they are feeling such mourning, grief, and anger. Indeed, the discussion has the potential to further divide, hurt, and blame ordinary people who already feel very vulnerable and under attack. Perhaps the religious community can play a crucial role here, because it is itself an international community and not just an American one. We also should have the capacity for self-criticism and even repentance, while national governments are seldom good at either. The truth that most of the world knows is that the U.S. government has far too often supported military dictators in Latin and Central America, Asia, and Africa, who have murdered as many or more innocent people as Saddam Hussein. The truth is that the United States has not been an honest broker for Middle East peace and has not sought the proper balance between Israeli security and Palestinian human rights. The truth is that American and Western appetites for oil have led to a corrupt and corrupting relationship with despicable Arab regimes. The truth is that the United States sits atop and is the leader of a global economy in which half of God's children still live on less than $2 a day, and the United States will be blamed around the world for the structures of injustice that such a global economy daily enforces. To speak these truths is very hard, sometimes especially in American middle-class congregations, but speaking hard truths is part of the prophetic religious vocation. Yet such a hard conversation could illuminate the confusion many Americans feel and could actually help in the necessary process of national healing while offering practical guidance for preventing such atrocities in the future. It takes courage to face difficult questions. President Abraham Lincoln, unlike most American presidents, pushed the nation to look at its own sins in a time of crisis, to dig deep into our spiritual traditions, and ask whether we are on God's side rather than the other way around. We desperately need a Lincoln-esque quality of self-examination in this historical moment, but President Bush's speeches since September 11th have lacked it. So far, the White House has missed that opportunity in the path against terrorism that it has chosen. But despite the initial path the nation has taken, we still have the task of going to the roots of global terrorism, and the religious community must help the nation do that. Thank you. For the crucial work of self-examination, at least three things are important. First, in the necessary prophetic ministry of telling the truth about American global dominance and its consequences, we should be clear not to imply that America, including the victims of the September 11th attacks and their families, deserved that great day of evil as some kind of judgment, as Falwell, Robertson, and some left-wing critics have suggested. In a powerful statement released September 17, 2001, by Palestinian poets, writers, intellectuals, and political leaders, who all have deep grievances with American foreign policy in the Middle East, the line was drawn. No cause, not even a just cause, can make legitimate the killing of innocent civilians, no matter how long the list of accusations and the register of grievances. Terror never paves the way to justice, but leads down a short path to hell. Their statement was called, "But Then, Nothing. Nothing Justifies Terrorism," a sentence that should serve as a fitting final word in any discussion about all the injustice that lies behind terrorist acts. We must draw that same line. Second, we must not make the mistake of thinking that these terrorists are somehow freedom fighters who went too far. On the contrary, the people responsible for the September 11th attacks were not out to redress the injustices of the world. Osama bin Laden's network of terror simply creates great new oppressions, as was evidenced in the Taliban, the regime that represented their vision for the future. Their terror is not about correcting the great global gulf between haves and have-nots, about the lack of even-handed Middle East policies, or about the absence of democratic freedoms in corrupt Gulf states. The root of the terror attacks is not a yearning for economic justice for the poor and oppressed of the world. It is motivated, rather, by the ambition of a perverted religious fundamentalism for regional and global power, one that rejects the values of liberty, equality, democracy, and human rights. However much the United States has fallen short of those professed values and has often contradicted them, this terrorism is also an attack on the values themselves. It is not violence in their name or on their behalf. And if we are to tell the truth about America, let us also tell the truth about the terrorists. We are accustomed to thinking in a political and economic framework. This time, we need to shift and understand motivations that are more ideological and theological. The evil of bin Laden and his network of terror may have been foolishly strengthened by the support of the CIA during the Cold War, but this evil is not a creation of American power. Indeed, to suggest, as some on the left have done, that this terrorism is an understandable consequence of U.S. imperialism is a grave mistake of both moral and political analysis. The terror of bin Laden's al-Qaeda network is not just a reaction to American empire, but the radical assertion of an ambitious new religious and political empire of their own. Third, we must carefully distinguish between seeing global injustice as the cause of terrorism and understanding such dramatic inequalities as the breeding and recruiting ground for terrorism. Grinding and dehumanizing poverty, hopelessness, and desperation clearly fuel the armies of terror. But a more ideological and fanatical agenda is its driving force. Therefore, the call for global justice as a necessary part of any response to terrorism should never be seen as an accommodation, surrender, or even negotiation with the perpetrators of horrific evil. A serious agenda of global poverty reduction, for example, would be an attack on the terrorists' ability to recruit and subvert the wounded and angry for their hideous purposes, as well as being the right thing to do. Evidence shows that at times when the prospects for peace appeared more hopeful in the Middle East, the ability of terrorist groups operating in the region was greatly diminished. We must drain the swamps of injustice in which the mosquitoes of terror breed. But without seeming to justify or excuse the utterly inexcusable acts we witnessed in New York and Washington, we must not shirk from rooting out the terror we have experienced, but we must also commit ourselves to the prophetic task of examining its deeper roots. Above all, we must find a way to make this a teachable moment rather than merely a blame game. and a real international effort against terrorism must demonstrate a new compassion, generosity of spirit, and commitment to relieve the suffering of precisely those people who have been abandoned and abused. Yes, let us stop terrorist plans to hurt more people, but then let us undertake a massive and collective effort that clearly demonstrates the relationship between halting terrorism and removing injustice. Suffering people everywhere would see the clear signal, and the recruiters of pain would be dealt a death blow. It is indeed time for justice, for the perpetrators of terror, and for the people our global order has for so long left out and behind. How we respond to these murderous events will shape our future even more than the terrorists can. As the religious leader's statement pleaded, let us make the right choices. But since September 11th, our government has made many bad choices. Military spending and national security needs have demanded so much of our attention and resources that there is little left over for anything else. We've seen the loss of crucial civil liberties in the name of national security. The healthy desire for energy independence has been used to justify drilling in sensitive environmental habitats. Primarily military solutions to terrorism threaten to dominate the nation's foreign policy for years to come, leading to wider wars, recruiting even more terrorists, and fueling an unending cycle of violence. And the critical questions of how to defeat terrorism and resolve conflicts in less violent ways have been given far less attention than they deserve. We saw evil on September 11th, and the world was horrified. But to describe our own nation as only good, as President Bush has done, is to miss the critical moment for self-reflection. Instead of facing the many roots of this evil, we have turned away from our own responsibilities. Yes, September 11th has set us back. Instead of looking to ourselves or to American foreign policy to see how we have contributed to the grievances and injustice that breed terrorism, we now face the spiritual danger of defining the struggle as simply a battle between good and evil. Poverty has fallen off the national agenda. Food banks, soup kitchens, shelters, and many other social service providers are suffering from diminishing donations. Faith-based organizations around the country are reporting shortfalls, and fearful people have not been challenged to be generous people. But I still believe there are opportunities to respond to the horrible events of September 11th in better ways, invitations even for national transformation. In the days following the attacks, it was difficult to find parking spaces outside our churches, synagogues, and mosques. The deeply felt need for spiritual resources and insight in a confusing and fearful time can drive us to deeper places, not just provide a religious affirmation for American patriotism and civil religion. Faith communities can still help provide moral and political guidance in this crisis and even offer prophetic words of what kind of people we ought now to be. On September 11th, Americans joined the world. Our sense of national invulnerability was shattered. Instead of just bombing every country where terrorists live and telling the world, "You're either with us or against us," we might actually reach out to a world that, until now, too few Americans have really understood. There have been some positive signs. In public schools, students have begun to study Arabic. In churches where I have preached, local imams have been invited to speak about Islam and attracted far more people than expected. Now could be the perfect time to finally demand a Middle East peace settlement that is just for both Palestinians and Israelis, thereby addressing the most grievous source of anger among Arabs and Muslims. It could also be the right time to support democracy in the Arab world, where official stupidity, greed, and oppression have helped to create the dangerous grievances that led to terrorism. It could also be the right time to undertake major economic relief and reconstruction in the entire region of the Middle East, which could win more hearts and minds away from terrorism than will endless bombing campaigns. The debate about which path to take, about what our response to terrorism should be, is far from over. It is still taking place in conversations across America, in the religious community, and, I hope, at the highest levels of political power. The outcome of that debate will shape our future even more than the terrorists can. We can still make the right choices in this crisis and, in so doing, point the way to a safer and better world. September 11th will ultimately become either a doorway to transformation or the excuse for our worst instincts and old habits. It depends on the choices we still have to make. Saddam Hussein was an evil ruler, no doubt about it. Add to that description, extraordinarily brutal and unbelievably cruel. But that was not enough for a war. Other heads of state have also been horrifically evil, including some who have been allies of the United States, like Saddam during Iraq's war with Iran. Iraq had used chemical weapons against the Iranian people and the Kurds, and the world had every reason to believe that he hoped to acquire more of them, and would use them again if it suited his purposes. But without solid evidence of an imminent threat from his chemical and biological weapons, or irrefutable intelligence that he was close to possessing nuclear weapons, that was not enough for a war either. Many other nations have weapons of mass destruction too, including the United States and many of its allies, Israel in particular. The question was what Saddam's evil meant for the world, whether there was an urgent threat from his weapons, and of course, what response would be both effective and consistent with Christian ethics. Whatever Christians decide about wars like the one in Iraq, they must do it on the basis of Christian theology. Liking and trusting President George W. Bush, as many conservatives do, or hating him, as many liberals do, is just not relevant here. Patriotism means loving your country and its best ideals, enough even to oppose it when it is grievously wrong. And Christian faithfulness always supersedes patriotism. American Christians often need to be reminded that we are a worldwide church, the body of Christ, and what other Christians around the world think about what the United States does ought to be at least as important to us as the views of our fellow citizens. Judging from all the letters, statements, and articles that came across my desk, most churches around the world and across the theological spectrum did not support the U.S. arguments for going to war with Iraq, which gets us back to theology. Christian peacemaking always calls churches to seek alternatives to war in resolving conflicts. Both the just war and pacifist traditions agree with that. And there were alternative ways to deal with Iraq's potential development of weapons of mass destruction. What was needed was a carrot-and-stick diplomacy. United Nations Security Council resolutions had called for the destruction, removal, or rendering harmless of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons along with ballistic missiles in Iraq. And the United States and the international community were right to force the return of UN weapons inspectors to Iraq. It should have happened earlier. The inspections had begun to accomplish their purpose in enforcing UN resolutions and should have been aggressively completed. The containment of Saddam Hussein was possible without the risks and costs of military attack. Saddam and his Iraqi regime should have been disarmed of any and all weapons of mass destruction, and it could have been done without war. The international community could have united in an effective strategy to isolate, contain, disarm, and ultimately undermine and remove the brutal and dangerous regime of Saddam Hussein. Instead, it was pressured to support the war agenda of the world's last remaining superpower. As for the reasonable goal of regime change, the Iraqi people themselves could have been supported internationally to create civil resistance within their own country to achieve that goal. Saddam Hussein and his government had cruelly repressed the Iraqi people and were a real threat to other countries in the region and potentially to the world. He had used chemical weapons and had stockpiled biological weapons, and he was trying hard, though unsuccessfully, we have learned, to acquire nuclear weapons. The United Nations had repeatedly demanded that Iraq stop its violations of human rights, stop threatening peace in the region, stop its attempts to develop additional weapons of mass destruction, and respect the role of the world community through the United Nations in accomplishing these important goals. But a military attack was simply not the only way to pursue these legitimate goals. Instead, international law, political wisdom, and collective action around moral principles could have guided our actions. Neither international law nor Christian just war doctrine allow preemptive military action by one state against another. The UN Charter and international law only allow for individual states to go to war in situations of self-defense or after an armed attack. And in both international law and just war doctrine, there are scrupulous conditions even for self-defense. For the United States to unilaterally initiate military action was a dangerous precedent. It severely undermined the system of international security established since World War II. Iraq had not attacked the United States and had not been credibly implicated in the September 11th terrorist attacks, despite the continual rhetoric from the White House implying Saddam was linked to them. Nor was a clear and convincing case ever made that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were an immediate or imminent danger to other countries in the surrounding region or the rest of the world. While Saddam Hussein would obviously have liked to have had nuclear weapons, there was no evidence that his finger was resting on the button that would trigger mass murder. The manipulation of intelligence to support a preemptive war with Iraq became one of the worst distortions of fact in modern history. A war against Iraq, many warned beforehand, could have serious consequences for future American foreign policy if the United States and the United Kingdom acted alone. Many of our allies, both in Europe and in the Arab world, were opposed to war. It would create explosive and long-term consequences in a region that was already facing serious unrest. And, as later events demonstrated, very little attention had been given to what would follow the war to remove Saddam Hussein. America simply didn't have an exit strategy or a plan for the years of rebuilding, international economic aid, and development of new political institutions that would be required to avoid post-war chaos. The ongoing international intelligence gathering and law enforcement's efforts against terrorism were producing real results, with significant arrests of terrorist leaders and the exposure of secret cells. The cooperation of countries around the world, particularly Arab and Muslim nations, in this effort was undercut by our war with Iraq. Hatred against the United States has grown, leading to new volunteers for further terrorist attacks against the West in new countries like Spain and even Saudi Arabia. Prophetic religious voices said the United States would certainly win a war against Iraq, but could lose the struggle against international terrorism. Most important, a war with Iraq raised serious moral questions. Untold thousands of Iraqi civilians would be killed, as well as many young Americans. The impact on families and loved ones in our own society would be enormous. Despite White House self-confidence, the United States has yet to recognize how the real threats of terrorism are very different from what we have known as war, to which we simply respond with our habitual military solutions. Instead of seeing the events of September 11th as a new call for international cooperation and collaboration in addressing a host of global problems, the Bush administration quickly retrenched into Pax Americana, going it alone, as the world's only superpower. Our choices included the rule of law or the habit of war, collective action or unilateral decisions, effective containment or unpredictable escalation. And the Bush administration made the wrong choices. In a demonstration of unity never seen before, virtually every world church body in the United States and the world that spoke out on the prospect of war with Iraq, with the notable exception of the American Southern Baptists, concluded this was not a just war. And churches everywhere spoke out against it, including Catholic, Protestant, Evangelical, and Pentecostal bodies from around the world. Many churches didn't speak on the subject, and of course, many American congregations were in sympathy with the president on Iraq. But it was highly significant that whenever a church body considered the theological merits of a U.S. war with Iraq and decided to speak, they spoke against the war. They claimed a war with Iraq would be illegal, unwise, and immoral. The worldwide church's opposition to the war in Iraq has been shown by subsequent events to be quite prophetic. The end of the U.S. invasion turned out not to be the end of the war, and has left Iraq and the world with horrible problems. The Bush administration chose an American military occupation of Iraq instead of an internationally supported UN initiative in humanitarian aid and reconstruction. Terrible violence has been the result ever since, more than anyone expected or predicted. The U.S. military still hasn't found any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and U.S. officials are not confident about ever doing so. The central justification for the war turned out not to be there. But what is there are huge numbers of American soldiers, perhaps for a very long time. The cost in lives, both American and Iraqi, in the post-war period has been utterly tragic, and the sacrifice of American military families has gone on longer than anybody contemplated. The specter of endless chaos and conflict, and even eventual civil war between Iraq's contentious factions, looms ever before us. Three large questions remain. First, American leaders feel vindicated in prosecuting a preemptive and mostly unilateral war, and are justifying that policy for the future. The media are already speculating on who will be next. Iran and Syria seem to be prime candidates. Is this the kind of world we want, where the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the world makes all the big decisions? Second, the humanitarian war fought to liberate Iraq raises the question of why only this gross violator of human rights was chosen. What about the many others? Will the United States now choose to liberate people in countries where American geopolitical interests and the economic stakes are not as high, say in the Congo or Sudan? Third, what about the emerging doctrine of Pax Americana, where the neoconservatives who now virtually run the U.S. government are openly speaking the language of dominance and empire as the moral foundation for American foreign policy? The Pentagon has yet to renounce plans for permanent military bases in Iraq. Perhaps of special concern for Christians is the president's increasingly religious language to justify American war and domination. Do we really believe that America and George W. Bush have been divinely appointed to root out evil in the world? That's bad theology, and a very dangerous one. All this has resulted from the war with Iraq. Yes, I am very glad that Saddam is gone, but there were better ways to accomplish that worthy goal and to set into motion precedents that would have left us in a much more healthy and hopeful place than we now find ourselves. This war isn't yet over, and its consequences have just begun. Iraq remains chaotic, unstable, and highly lethal. Divided factions threaten any political solution. The United States made much of its plans to turn over sovereignty to a new Iraqi government, the timing of which was clearly tied to the American election. The real issue of how successful the transfer to Iraqi sovereignty will be remains to be seen. It is indeed a good thing that the brutal regime of Saddam Hussein is over, but that worthy goal should and could have been accomplished over time in much better ways than a preemptive and largely unilateral war that has proved to be both unnecessary and unjust. Iraq is now a huge mess with no clear U.S. exit strategy in sight, and is likely to remain so for a very long time. The Bush administration's argument that the war with Iraq was a critical battle in the war on terrorism is also not compelling. In his enormously influential book, Against All Enemies, Inside America's War on Terror, and his riveting testimony before the 9/11 Commission, Richard Clark, former counterterrorism czar in both the Clinton and Bush administrations, shocked the nation by charging that the U.S. government ignored clear warning signs of the impending al-Qaeda attack, and then pursued an unnecessary war against Iraq that has distracted America's attention from the real terrorist threats and made us less safe. The Iraq war may ultimately make the defeat of terrorism more difficult because of the division it caused among key allies, the deeper resentment it has triggered in Muslim countries, and the failure of the war policy to produce the promises of democracy in Iraq or the beginning of a Middle East peace agreement, all of which seem further away than ever. The war in Iraq has, indeed, proved to be a great distraction and diversion from the fight against terrorism, rather than a necessary component. Already, one-third of Afghanistan is back under Taliban control. Osama bin Laden has yet to be found, and the networks of terror are more dispersed throughout the world, and Al-Qaeda has carried out more successful and massive terrorist attacks in Spain and elsewhere, now even in the Arab world. In Spain, 191 people died from bombs on commuter trains in the spring of 2004, with more than 2,000 injured. Right-wing American columnists had the audacity to attack the Spanish people for caving in to terrorists because they defeated the pro-American Spanish Party in subsequent elections. What they don't say is that the vast majority of the Spanish people were against their government's decision to support the U.S. war with Iraq, which was therefore an undemocratic decision. Or that the ruling party lied to the Spanish people in an attempt to blame the commuter train attacks on a local group and distract attention from Al-Qaeda. What the U.S. government and its media allies seemed to be saying was that the proper response of the Spanish people after being bombed should have been to vote for the continuing policies of George W. Bush. They didn't, because like most of the world's people, they had seen enough. Although President Bush and his top advisors have yet to admit it, continuing events in Iraq reveal fundamental miscalculations and multiple policy failures on the part of the administration. And yet, instead of addressing these egregious and ongoing mistakes,